Hello, reader. You're plugged in to another episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. We hope you enjoy it.
Hello, everyone. My name is Gus Solber. I'm a journalist and author with a special interest in the power of comedy as a force for helping us interpret, understand, and maybe even cope with the chaos of the world. But enough about me. I'm very happy to be sitting in the studio today with one of the masters of the form, a stand-up comedian, a scriptwriter, co-writer of the football anthem Football's Coming Home, writer of a series of popular children's books, author of the topical and much-discussed Jews Don't Count, and now the author of a brilliant family memoir titled My Family, which is hysterically funny and deeply moving in equal measure. David Baddiel, welcome. It's a great pleasure to be talking to you
Lovely
today.
Lovely to meet you, Gus. Thank you very much. I didn't know that you had a special interest in using comedy to sort of sort out and process the most complicated things in the world. That's sort of me that you're describing there. I mean, we're getting on to talk about it, but I think the memoir about my family and my early life is at heart. It's about the salvational power of comedy.
That's exactly what I'm going to be talking to you about. Thank you, David. So if I can begin by misquoting Tolstoy, every Jewish family is alike, but every Meshuggah Jewish family is Meshuggah in their own way.
You're not Jewish, but you've done very well with the pronunciation there. So well done.
I'm Jewish.
Oh, you are Jewish. Yes. Sorry. My Judah was all over the place for a second.
Judah. I hope I don't have to translate Meshuggah for everyone. That would be crazy of me.
Shall I explain it?
Yeah, why not?
Because actually, it's the bit in the book where I try and explain the word Meshuggah. Don't know if you remember, but I'm talking about how my dad didn't really respond to quite a lot of the mad things that my mother did. And I say, I can only describe this using Yiddish, by saying for my dad, everything my mum did was a mishigas, which is like a madness, right? And then I have to explain mishigas is from Meshuggah, which means mad person. And I talk about it at quite some length for a little crash course in Yiddish for the reader.
Right. I think that is one of the joys of the book. It's fundamentally Jewish. And yeah, it'll make a heck of a lot of sense to anyone who is Jewish. And yet at the same time, you don't have to be Jewish, as the saying goes.
No, I think you really don't in this particular book. I don't think you have to be Jewish to read Jews Don't Count, to be honest. It has a different impact whether you're Jewish or not. But this book, it definitely, the Jewish context is unbelievably important to it. But really, the Tolstoy quote is interesting because it's about family and the specific, very, very specific transgressions and madness that went on in my early life. I'm using it, I think, to try and chime with the universal thing, which is all families are kind of mental. All families have madnesses, all families have enormous eccentricities and idiosyncrasies, and my basic point is we should celebrate those, find the comedy in them, rather than, as we tend to do, particularly in death and in memorialization, to slightly cover them up if they're at all embarrassing or transgressive or involve sex, which my mother's definitely did, and my father's, that we tend to sort of brush all that over because of a notion that we have to idealise the dead. And for me, that's a disservice to the dead because you don't remember someone by considering them to be an idealistic angel.
Right. So, David, how old were you when you first came to realise that your family was, to use your own words, weird, eccentric, balmy, and not very informed of the normal ways of the world? Was there any specific epiphany, any specific moment when you thought, wow, we're different?
Well, I think to some extent I didn't know that when I was a child, because I think the key way in which families are like I've just described is because they normalize a way of behavior that is specific to them, and then only when you come out of that household do you realize not everyone conducts their family life like this. Everyone conducts their family life in a strange way, but it's different for each family. My friend Frank Skinner, the comedian, who once said a very dark thing, but I'm going to say it anyway because I think it's correct, which is he talked about how when he worked in a factory, a man who he worked with once told him that he so couldn't bear the way his wife ate her cornflakes that he'd started wearing an enormous pair of headphones stuffed with tissue paper every breakfast. And then Frank said this dark thing, which he said, and that's how Fred and Rose West started. I don't know if people know here, but Fred and Rose West were terrible serial killers and mainly killed members of their family. And what he means by that is, I think, that very odd things by increments can happen behind closed doors, and you think they're normal, and then the next thing seems to be normal, but it isn't, and then it, you know what I mean? You can, I mean, luckily I never had anything terrible and dark happen, but strange stuff happened, and it happened in a way that by the time it was happening, I didn't think it was abnormal. So maybe it was only in my 20s that I looked back and started to think, and became a comedian, and thought, I'm going to use my own life as source material. I thought, that's lucky. Turns out I've had a really weird and crazy early life, which I can use.
David, just touching on the universality of your story, and I grew up in a very, very different world to you. I grew up on the West Rand of Johannesburg, extremely different in a small kind of very small Jewish community, and yet I found absolute echoes of my own story. Looking back, having written your family memoir, do you kind of ever get the feeling that you, in a way, were writing other people's memoirs by proxy? Have you had this experience of people saying to you, man, that's my story?
A lot, yeah. I also did it as a, before I wrote it as a memoir, this material provided a stand-up show. I did it in the West End. I, in fact, did it all over the world. I did it in Australia and Canada. And after the show, I would often have people coming up to me and saying, they would say two things. One is, I feel I really know particularly your mum. So that was great because it felt to me like what I'm trying to do is go against the idea that if you just say someone's wonderful, you know, then you don't have any sense of who they actually were. Whereas if you talk about them very, very truthfully and very specifically, people, they live in the memory in a very real way. But the other thing I had was people saying, oh, it's just like my family. And we haven't really discussed this yet. We haven't said the thing. But I would say to them, what, your mother had an affair with a golfing memorabilia salesman and then turned your entire lives over to golfing memorabilia? And they would say, no, but it sort of felt similar anyway. And that's true, because the more specific you are, the more you tend to chime with the universal. With a spin, I would say, which is I think that, and I explore this a lot in the memoir, I think that my mother's early life, the fact that she was a refugee from Nazism when she was a baby, and then had a very traumatic time as a child with her father being interned, which is something that happened in Britain, and then he was very depressed after the war, essentially a Holocaust intergenerational trauma thing. I think that the tragicomic way that she lived her life, always searching for glamour, not finding it because she was married to my Welsh working class dad, but trying to find it in the absurd world of golf memorabilia, that was comic, but at the same time it had a very tragic element to it. And I think maybe quite a lot of post-Holocaust intergenerational Jewish families had something similar, where they're trying to find a lost world somehow.
So, David, as you mentioned, you celebrate your mother and your father in actually a very warm way. It's not a eulogy. At the same time, it is definitely a celebration. And you talk a lot about the Jewish tradition as well when somebody in your family passes for somebody to say to a mourner, I wish you long life, which kind of suggests that you're still around. Yeah. Maybe you have a long life.
It's so Jewish.
Yeah, and you deflect attention in a way from the person who's passed onto the person who has survived.
Yes.
Just expand on that a little bit.
I think I say in the book that it's sort of a very Jewish thing, this idea of deferred happiness that now is bad, but later on it'll be better somehow, because Jews have had it bad over many centuries. And therefore they're always thinking, well, maybe it'll get better somehow. And I think that's where that tradition comes from, of on Simcha, and indeed saying, I wish you long life to the person who's still alive. But it's another thing as well, which I think Jewish, as far as I understand it, I actually don't know that. I mean, I went to a very Jewish primary school, but my understanding theologically of Judaism remains sometimes sketchy. But I think I wrote a book called The God Desire, which is about my particular type of atheism, and there isn't really a very clear Jewish conception of the afterlife. And that's partly because I think Judaism is a religion mainly designed about coping psychologically with the here and now. And the way you do that is by having 613 things, a kind of OCD thing that you have to do every day. You have to wind this thing around your arm, and you have to not turn this light on, and you have to cook this fish in this way, but not this fish. It's like very, very, a load of rules, and they help you deal with the real threat, which is that someone's going to come and burn your village down at any point, right? And so I think that's what Judaism is, which is why at the moment of death, it's not about the afterlife. It's not about the great hereafter. It's about, like, well, are you coping? Because I think Judaism is a coping strategy at some level.
Yes. Can you just briefly talk, because you've written about this quite substantially, not just in your memoir, can you reconcile being an atheist with actually being so incredibly Jewish? Is there no paradox in that?
No paradox at all. I mean, I mean, some people will think it's a paradox, but there's a number of very important things. Number one, the most important thing, and this is in Jews Don't Count, it was probably the moment in Jews Don't Count where people who didn't really understand what I was saying understood it. And that was when I said, like, you probably think that anti-Semitism is a kind of religious intolerance and not really racism and doesn't really deserve the term racism. So here's the problem with that. I'm an atheist. That would have made no difference to whether or not I got a free pass out of Auschwitz. None at all. The Gestapo would still have arrested me or shot me tomorrow. They didn't care, and racists don't care, and anti-Semites don't care whether you keep kosher, how often you go to synagogue. So that makes it racism, because it's just about your blood, right? It's the fact you're born Jewish that makes you something that has to be destroyed. Okay, so that's the most important thing. The thing about being an atheist in terms of being a Jew is that, firstly, a Jew... and some people think this is very negative, but I just think it's just true. A Jew is partly about anti-Semitism. You're aware all the time of the fact that you might at any point be carted off by anti-Semites, and you know that they don't care about whether or not you're religious. So therefore, that's what makes an atheist Jew, right? But interesting enough, I tell this story, and this is a funny story, I think, in the book about how there's so many Jews who consider themselves Jews but also atheists. And I occasionally get asked to do things for the Jewish community in Britain, and I got phoned by my local rabbi once, a man I don't know because I don't go to synagogue, but somehow he got my number, presumably because Jews control the world. He got my number, and he said, would you come along and light the menorah outside our synagogue? You'd be the local Jewish celebrity who does that. And I didn't want to do that. That felt like a naff thing to do. So I played my trump card. I said, sorry, Rabbi, I'm an atheist. And he said, so am I. And I thought, really, there's more Jewish atheists than I thought. But I think the other thing, I mean, the more gentle thing is, of course, a Jew can be a Jew via culture and tradition and music and comedy and all sorts of things that raise the goose pimples on your flesh about being Jewish without believing in Hashem.
You talk about your mother, who I think is one of the great through lines in my family. She had a passionate love affair with golf, and indeed with the golfer.
I would say she had a passionate love affair with a golfing memorabilia salesman, and the side effect of that, a very, very extreme side effect, was that she became very obsessed with golf and golfing memorabilia, but it was always erotic. It was always based on an erotic charge for David White, the golfing man.
You grew up in a household full of golf paraphernalia because your mother was interested in golf memorabilia. How did that affect your relationship with golf? Do you play golf? Would you?
Well, latterly in my life, well, I'm a big football fan, as you mentioned earlier, and my dad was always very, despite being Welsh, which is mainly a rugby-playing nation, was always very keen on football, and we used to play football all the time. And so one of the things that was particularly weird about my mother's sudden diving into the world of golf and golfing memorabilia. So no one liked golf in our house. It was totally a sport no one ever showed any interest in. My mum didn't show interest in sport in general. So I found it, I mean, obviously it was incongruous. I never really played golf. There is a moment right at the start of the book, a kind of cold open to the book, where I'm being taught how to do a golf swing by, it turns out, my mother's lover. And actually, I remember that moment quite clearly. And I remember, which I'm not sure is described in the book, hitting the ball pretty well. Like hitting it and thinking, oh, that's quite satisfying. I quite enjoyed it. But much, much later on, I did in fact go to play golf with Frank Skinner in the Algarve in Portugal. And I was shit. And maybe I was shit because I was psychologically refusing. You know, that some part of me said, no, you don't want to play golf. It's associated with, you know, your mother's affair and all sorts of things.
Okay, so there's a bit of a Freudian connection there.
Maybe, I don't know. I also think it's quite a difficult game. By the way, another thing about golf, which could be very, very deeply Freudian. I remember a friend of mine pointed this out to me. He said to me when I was talking about this, first of all, on stage, he said, well, of course, Jews were restricted in golf clubs in Great Britain. They weren't allowed to be members of golf clubs still in the 1970s in Britain. So my mother's aspiration might have had a slight element of that to it, a slight element of overcoming that and seeing that aspirationally as somewhere she wanted to be. Maybe it suggested safety to her because that's a place where there aren't Jews, or at least Jews won't be found. I don't know. It's quite complicated.
So, David, you also speak in the book, you mention being in therapy, you talk about therapy, but writing this memoir must have put you in the therapist's chair rather than on the couch for a change. How did that experience, was it therapeutic for you? Was it
cathartic? Well, I gave up therapy a little while ago, quite a long time ago. I was in therapy for a long time, partly because I just enjoyed it. I sort of like talking about my inner life, and partly because I was quite depressed in my 30s for lots of other reasons, some of which was clearly to do with my childhood. I tend to say this thing, which is very true, which is that one of the things I talked about in therapy was that I'd been in some relationships with women that weren't the right relationships for me, but I found them very difficult to get out of. I always find any relationship, not just sexual ones, relationships with people I'm working with, very difficult to get out of. I don't like the confrontation and the separation involved with that. The problem was that after 8 years in therapy, I realized I couldn't split up with my therapist, and that wasn't a good thing. So I had to break up that relationship too, somehow. I think now I am empowered and feel capable intellectually of putting myself in the therapist's chair enough. But also for me, it's not just putting myself in the chair. It's, again, to come back to it, it's about comedy. And I think, genuinely, I think comedy has been salvational for me insofar as I had quite a, you know, transgressive early life. There was a lot of stuff that might have impacted quite badly on me. But very quickly, and at quite a young age, I started to think it was funny. And the minute you start to think it's funny, it's quite hard to take the damage seriously. And once that happens, you are detached from it in quite a protective way. And maybe that's therapeutic in itself.
Freud famously said that there's no such thing as a joke.
Yeah, and Freud himself was not much of a stand-up, though.
No. And you say, which I think is kind of related, you say that comedy is truth. Truth is comedy, it must be rooted in truth to be funny, which suggests that people who go to comedy for escape are actually being really forced to confront truths that they might otherwise try and avoid. Just tell me about that idea of comedy being truth.
Well, so to be clear, that's for me, like the way that I process my life comically often involves, you know, being very, very honest and trying very much to, you know, talk about stuff that maybe people are embarrassed or ashamed about that I don't seem to have shame about, and I can make it funny and all the rest of it. There's lots of types of comedy that are not like that. Slapstick and just silly comedy, much of which I really love, sketch comedy that I've done. So you don't have to have absolute truth in the way that I'm talking about it. Although having said that, even very, very silly comedy probably has some kind of truth in it, because one thing I think is true about comedy is that it completely banishes and or disregards or deconstructs the idea of adulthood. So we are all winging adulthood, right? We are all pretending to be grown-ups. I know me and you are probably of an age, but at heart, we are still essentially children. No one really, really grows up. And so, for example, I did a sketch, which is very successful when I first started doing comedy, where I played one of two old history professors, very distinguished old men, who just ended up slagging each other off like children. And that was the whole sketch, and people loved it because it told that truth, which is no matter how much self-importance humans seem to have, at heart they're babies. And a lot of slapstick and clowning is about that truth.
So we actually can't, that's very Freudian, isn't it? We can't really escape our childhood because we are kind of our childhood.
That's correct. Yeah. I think that's true. Yeah.
You talk about your mother's kind of hoarding, and also you suggest that your father was a hoarder himself. Has that gene been passed on to you? Is there anything you hoard?
No, not really. I did try, actually. I think I was influenced enough by my parents when I was a kid. And I think when I was a kid, and even when I was a teenager, I was influenced. I hadn't detached enough from my parents. I didn't realize that they were mad. And so some of the things that they were doing, I tried to do as well, including I tried to collect things. And my mum would often decide. You know, I think I talk about this. There were these Billy Bunter books, which were books from the 1920s, that my mum decided that I should collect, and in fact enrolled me in something called the Old Boys Book Club, which was a club of people who liked those books. And she would leave me at meetings of the Old Boys Book Club where I was 11 and everyone else was 70. And I would sit there for hours thinking something's wrong here, but not really understanding it until much later. And nothing terrible happened, I should say. Anyway, I don't actually. I now find it impossible almost to collect anything, I think, in reaction to my parents. And also, I'm just not very good at archiving. They were good at that, particularly my mum. She sort of knew where all her massive amount of golfing memorabilia was, but I wouldn't be able to do that.
When you told your father what you were going to study and that you weren't going to become a scientist, he actually said to you, "What a waste of a brain."
Yeah.
How did that affect you? Did it make you defiant? Did it make you kind of feel ashamed of what you were doing?
Well, so there are a few points in the book where I think I'm pushing it in terms of the boundaries of sympathy with my parents, which I want to do because it's not a eulogy, as you say, and it is a celebration, but it's about the, as Leonard Cohen said, the crack is where the light gets in. It's about celebrating the flaws and bad behaviour some of the time, and they are not good parents. And one in which they're not good parents is that me, as a parent, responding as I do to what modern parenting should be, I have two children, are very much like with my children. It's like, whatever your talent is, find your destiny, my child. Fly, my pretties, fly into the world or whatever. It's all that. My dad was like, no, science, because he was an absolute mad science is king person. He should all be science. My older brother, who wasn't a good scientist, had done chemistry, physics, maths at A level and got D's and E's and done really badly just because it was so, that's all that matters as far as my dad was concerned. And we were all frightened of my dad, really. So it took a lot of courage for me to say to him, after a teacher had said to me, why are you doing, because I nearly did choose those subjects as well, why are you doing science subjects, you're rubbish at it. And then I did English and history and I was much better. But to tell my dad that, I remember going up to him, I can remember the scene. He was sitting at the in the table having just eaten. I think I chose that moment thinking he won't be so cross if he's just eaten, and saying to him, I'm not going to do science. And yeah, he just said, it's a waste of a brain. That was it. And yeah, I was definitely deflated, like I was deflated when I put my head on his shoulder and he said in a slightly camp voice, oh, I didn't know you cared, right? Meaning, well, are you gay? Again, like so wrong in terms of good parenting. It's sort of, I do think it's funny, but I think it's quite edgy funny because I think there's no question I can remember as a child that stuff being, yeah, very, very sort of deflating.
One of the things I loved about my family was the very thin line between poignancy and comedy, and occasionally I'd kind of laugh out loud and then I'd feel slightly guilty about it. And one example is when your brother Ivor goes back to the rabbi and says, after his bar mitzvah, you know, can you turn me from a man back into a boy? Now, that's very funny, but it's also very poignant, given that your brother Ivor had schizophrenia.
Well, he didn't have schizophrenia, so I'm going to have to correct that.
Okay.
He had a cannabis psychosis that was misdiagnosed as schizophrenia.
A misdiagnosis.
Yeah. But he showed all the symptoms of schizophrenia. I mean, he was mad. He was classically mad while he had the cannabis psychosis. He would do things like, you know, walk down roads in London with a green hat and a flute and say, I'm the Pied Piper. I mean, that kind of classically mad. And yeah, it was very, very difficult for Ivor, who I think the book is dedicated to Ivor. It's dedicated to both my brothers, but principally Ivor, because I think comedy has saved me. And the other thing that saved me is Ivor, is that I think he was a very protective older brother, and the sort of madness and neglect of my family life, because my parents were very neglectful at some level because they were just off doing their own mad shit. Ivor was sort of my dad, I think, and I think my sanity is a lot to do with him. So I found it very, very difficult when Ivor went crazy, which he did in his early 20s after smoking too much dope. And yeah, he does go to the rabbi who permits him. I think he also, I don't know if I say this in the book, he also said to the rabbi, who's called Louis Jacobs, quite a famous British rabbi, he says, can you tell me the entirety of the Old Testament and the Talmud while standing on one leg? Which I think is something that I think rabbis are meant to be able to do. I think there's some old Jewish folktale that they're meant to be able to do that. But he said no. Louis Jacobs, who's probably about 90, then said, no, I can't do that.
Now, you describe yourself in the book also as an honesty addict, as somebody with no judgment or shame.
Yeah.
For other people, it would have been quite difficult to write about those things. Did you not have difficulty writing about? You simply put them down from your head onto the screen?
No, I mean, really not. The problem I have, I think, is like there might be things that I might say that might upset or offend someone, and I find it very difficult to not put them in because I want to tell the whole story. And, you know, I'm not very worried about the dead people. I don't think we tell stories for the dead. I know it's an act of love. I know at some level it's an act of celebration. I was worried about my brothers, about what they might think. And we can talk about that if you like, because it's an interesting story. But in terms of like shame and judgment, I just don't have those things. Shame in itself is not something I've experienced. I think this is to do with my mother, who was utterly shameless. But also, I don't know. I don't have a voice in my head at all imagining what other people might think in a censorious way. I'm so obsessed with my own authenticity, which I think also comes from my mother in reaction to my mother. Because my mother was so performative. And at some level, living such a weird psychodrama, I think I'm very obsessed with my own authenticity. And so therefore, I can't be doing with worrying about what other people might think.
David, how do you measure the effectiveness of your comic writing? If you're on stage doing stand-up, let's say, you can measure by the barometer of audience reaction. Yeah. When you are writing, do you have a measure? Do you read your comedy out loud? Do you have any other way of seeing whether it's working, or is it simply, if it works for you, it'll work for the reader?
Kind of that. I've sort of got a pretty good tuning fork inside me for what's funny. I think that's probably my greatest natural skill. I don't think of myself as an amazing performer. Absolutely not. I'm quite a limited performer. I can't do any voices. I can't sing. I'm basically, as a comedian, just myself. I can't really do characters. But what I can do, particularly with words, is I know how to shape words. So was that a noise? I know how to shape words so that they are the funniest rhythm they can be for that particular joke. If you give me a jumble of words, that then there's a joke in there, I can shape them so they're as funny as they can be. And I'm very confident about that. I do, of course, since it's come out, have read loads of it in front of audiences, and it's got laughs. It also has the advantage that it was partly a stand-up show before I wrote it. So I have that advantage too. And actually, the book is still structured quite similarly to the stand-up show, particularly with the pictures. So those pictures were on PowerPoint. Those pictures that are in the book, in the stage show, they would be on a massive PowerPoint screen. So my mum's emails, my mum's erotic poetry, pictures of her, pictures of my dad, films, all that in the stage show were on a PowerPoint screen. So I basically reproduce that in the book in a way that was quite important to me. I would say to the editors, no, you can't put that picture there because that's a kind of punchline. So you have to put it underneath the words for it to work as a punchline.
David, if I can just quickly, before we wrap up, go back to your story about the rabbi who was also an atheist in response to you saying you're an atheist. There's a very well-known theory that ultimately God is laughing at us, whether we believe in him or not. What's your thought about that idea that there's a cosmic joke being played on all of us?
Well, I don't believe in God, so therefore, much as it's a nice idea to think that he is laughing at us, I don't believe that is true. But I do believe that life or reality or whatever is fundamentally comic. And one of the things that's fundamentally comic about it is that God doesn't exist. That's comic, right? Because we then make up shit. We make up thousands of legends that we absolutely believe in and centuries have believed in, about something that isn't true. That in itself is a comic notion. It's also tragic, but it's definitely comic. The fact that people have believed in a massive way, like built massive temples and gone to war and all that stuff about nonsense, about total nonsense, right? But I mean, in a way that I in the God Desire, am happy to deconstruct and talk about in a serious way, but it's made up. And so that itself is funny, I think. And I think my own feeling is that much of what happens in life is insupportable without comedy. And the only way that you can deal with some of the things that you are thrown at is by laughing at it. There's no, in the God Desire, which is, as I say, my book about atheism, it's based on the premise that I'm different from most atheists because I want God to exist and I acknowledge that desire. And that's what makes me know he doesn't, because I assume that everyone has that desire and communally we therefore create him. We project that desire into a thing that satisfies that desire. And at the end of the book, I sort of say, because I feel that the book needs an upbeat, that particular book, that people are looking for an upbeat and something that it isn't just meaningless and death is the end, like you want something. And I say there's all these things that normally end these books, are nature or the universe or love, and I dismiss all of them and I say there's only one thing. There's only one thing that makes us different from the animals and therefore we can think of like this higher thing, and it's laughter. Laughter is the only thing that makes us in any way higher than the animals and therefore that we can think of as kind of sacred.
David, it's been wonderful talking to you. Half an hour has been too short, but I'd like to close with a question that doesn't need an answer because it's rhetorical and it also strikes me as very Jewish. And it's three words that I think completely sum up your book and also kind of sum up life itself. And that's the question that you asked your brother Ivor when your father Colin passed away and you were sitting in the family home and you turned to him and you said, "So what else?"
Thank you very much.
Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. Did you love what you heard? Don't just stop at the stories. Buy the books. visit your favorite bookstore to grab your next read. And remember to subscribe, share, and join us again next week for more fascinating conversations. Until then, happy reading.